Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, Thursday, January 19th. The president-elect has arrived in Washington. Tomorrow at this time, we will be listening or perhaps analyzing, discussing the inaugural address, because the president will take the oath at about 11 o'clock. You'll hear that here live on 720 WGN and then listen to his inaugural speech after that. But before that, a man who should be president, Dennis Rodkin, is in the studio, writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. Don't you think maybe you'd make a fine president one day?
Oh, my.
Okay, maybe that day's passed.
I don't think I have the energy for it now, although he does, and he's 20 years older than I am.
I know, it's amazing, the guys and the schedules that they lead. And
yeah.
All that. Okay, we got a lot to talk about.
But thank you, Steve.
I want to jump into it. It was sincere.
I could tell.
You got a story out today about how the inventory, right, is there's kind of a dearth of real estate available.
Yeah, we hit a 9-year low a year ago, and now we've hit a 10-year low. We just keep there. This is city data only. I don't have the data for the suburbs, but low inventory has been the problem. It's a problem all over the country, but here in Chicago, we have the fewest homes for sale that we've had in at least 10 years. The data only goes back 10 years. So we probably have the lowest in longer than that. And that's a problem if you're a buyer, and it's also an issue if you're a seller.
Okay, tell me that, because I was going to say, if you're a seller, that seems to me like that's really good for you. Things are going to move quickly.
It is good. It'll move quickly. Of course, if it moves quickly, you then have to snap up your next house quickly.
Okay.
But the other thing, to me, the problem for a seller is there's this temptation. Any commodity that is rare is going to go for a higher price. So let's just say my house is worth 100. I decide I can put this thing out there for 140 because anybody will take it. And that turns around and bites you on the ankle, because even though inventory short, sales are quick in most city neighborhoods, buyers are very, very educated now. They look on the internet, they make comparisons, they watch what homes sell for. And if your house is overpriced, virtually any agent I talk to says that if your house is overpriced, the market will recognize it.
Is it right?
So that's the problem for a seller is, ooh, it looks like I can just throw that thing out there and it'll go, but it won't.
So the demand is there, but the frenzy isn't.
We don't seem to have the frenzy yet. Of course, it's January, but we have. The last time we really saw the frenzy at its height was in 2013. That could happen this year. Who knows? Don't know what's going to happen. We tend not to be quite as frothy, one agent said, as they are in the coastal markets. Buyers do have to be really prepared, like have your financing all lined up, know what your terms are, how long a closing can you put in the contract? Because again, your seller might have to run out and find another house. So if you're flexible with your other terms, you need to have your financing nailed down. But if you're flexible with your other terms, like you say, you know, we don't have to move in for 120 days, then the seller might say, ooh, then I prefer this contract. I'll sell to this person because it gives me some flexibility.
Okay, so you talked about the demand and all of that. You wrote a great piece about how to stage your house.
Yeah.
Great, because, you know, a lot of it's like, okay, we see this all the time, you know, bake cookies, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But the point of this is that curb appeal doesn't really matter so much anymore, because it's all about the internet. You have to make your house not just look good when someone walks into it, but when they scroll through it.
Right. Yeah, baking cookies doesn't work until we get smell-o-vision on our computers. Yeah, a very large piece of buyers' first, second round of shopping is online. So your pictures really have to look good. And you and I have talked about virtual staging. I've got that ugly pink room, and my agent can turn that room white just for the photos. But beyond that, you also need to make sure that the place really calls to people when they're looking at the pictures online. And so,
Okay, you know where I'm going now, because the experts were saying what should be put out to attract people are sparkly things.
Sparkling things. And I don't see any sparkly things in this studio.
I know.
So see,
I teased you an email that I was going to do that, but this building's been purchased. That's behind us.
Oh, that's true.
But really, so they're saying literally take away the, you know, old vase or the family photos and put something that glitters in.
Yeah,
and that's to attract people who are looking online.
Exactly. Well, and it also works when you're in the room. But first of all, sparkly things are trendy in home decorating anyway. So
well,
that's
who
one
knows?
Reason
I knew
you would
that.
Do it.
Absolutely.
And I know when you go home and do some decorating tonight, you'll probably be spreading sparkle everywhere.
It's glitter, actually, in my house.
Glitter, I'm sure. I could just picture that. But so it's, first of all, it's very popular, and part of what you're trying to do is make your home look like today, not like 10 years ago, in those photos and when people are walking through. But the other reason that they said to use sparkly things is that you're most likely painting your rooms in these real, you know, simple, flat, gray, beige real estate colors that appeal to everybody rather than the, you know, the honey gold that only appeals to some buyers. So it becomes a little flattened. So when you put in the sparkly things, the light sort of bounces around the room. People's eye will be pulled around the room, whether they're looking at the photos right. And they see a little bit of a glint, or they walk into the room and that glint is a little bit sharper.
It's just another one of the fascinating changes that we're going through, you know, that... Yeah. You know, curb appeal is nice, but really you got to get them to the curb. And to do that, you've got to have not just a nice presentation, but you've got to stage your house, not for the visit, but for the pictures for the web.
People don't get to the curb appeal until so much later in the buying or in the shopping process than they used to. Agents tell me, you know, their clients walk up or buyers walk up and they say, well, I need to see the kitchen because I didn't understand those handles on the lower left cabinet, that sort of thing. People have really examined those pictures and in their mind's eye walked into those rooms, and they generally have it. You know, you have a nice picture of the front of the house, so they have a good idea. And then they've done Google Maps to see what the neighborhood looks like. And really, curb appeal is very important, but it's not the first hit that it used to be.
You've got a piece up today also about this development in Winnetka. I think it's called The Win now.
It's now called The Win. So, it was called One Winnetka.
A bit of a high rise. We had George Kaiser in here yesterday from Wintrust talking about mortgages, and we came upon millennials. You also have a piece recently about millennials and how, I think it was LaGrange about a year ago I had on the show, how they're building high rises now near the train stations.
Yeah.
Because millennials don't drive, but towns want them in their mix.
Want you in the downtown, yeah.
Is that what this is about, The Win?
Well, in Winnetka, there may be some millennials who buy there, but I think the primary target there is the downsizer. I've got my big house in Winnetka where I raised all my kids. I don't want to go up and down stairs anymore. It's just the two of us, that sort of thing. So we would downsize into this. We, too, would want to be near the train because we want to get in. Let's say one of us is still working, the other's retired, want to get downtown for the opera, those kinds of things. Building something like that near the train line is important. And it also, the interesting thing about The Win, formerly known as One Winnetka, is that it's got this, it has been a little bit controversial because it's got this very sort of Parisian feel. And for some people in Winnetka, it feels like exactly what you should put in downtown Winnetka. And for some people in Winnetka, it feels like exactly the opposite. It doesn't feel like a village. It feels too cityfied for some people. And for others, this is exactly the sort of level of sophistication we're
looking for.
I love
it when the aesthetes argue.
Yeah, exactly.
Dennis Rodkin, read a lot more about this at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Steve.
It's 12:22. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Bill Geiger is in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Nice to be here, sir. Thank you.
We're talking, you know, maybe we'll talk about Washington in a couple of minutes or so, but Steve Mnuchin is on Capitol Hill, all sorts of things. And you come in to talk about retirement, what we should do. You know, Terry Savage was here a couple of weeks ago, and she had written a column about there's a retirement board or something like that in Washington, and a union had actually had gone to them and said, you know, we need to cut our pensions.
Steel workers.
And that it's legal to do, and that the government said, okay, you can do this.
That's exactly right. And it's a problem that we're seeing in pensions across the United States. If you're lucky enough to have one, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be around for you, at least in the same form, for the rest of your retirement.
Now, this particular authority is pretty limited, right? It's if it's a pension fund shared by a lot of different, I think they're basically unions with different sorts of workers. And
they are. But a bigger issue than that is if you have let me tell you a quick story. My father worked for a company his entire adult life.
Right.
His manufacturing company, retired with a pension. Within 5 years of him retiring, his company went bankrupt. The first thing that happened is an outfit called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation came in and took over the pension. The second thing that happened is they cut my father's pension in half.
So the pension survived, but not the whole pension.
Not the whole pension. My father predeceased my mother, so my mother was stuck with half a pension and one Social Security right. for another 13 years.
And so what do people do in that case? I mean, I guess you have to rely on just saving elsewhere, but the older generation, that's all they had was the pension.
That's right. But if you are coming up on retirement and you have a choice between a pension and a lump sum distribution, you should really think seriously about taking the lump sum distribution, because you can create your own private pension with that. That way you're not dependent upon your former employer for the rest of your retirement.
The downside is it's a guarantee of less money. All right. Let me put it differently. If you take the pension, you're guaranteed a certain rate. That's probably lower than the lump sum if you take it.
If you take a lump sum, in a lot of cases, you can have as much or more income coming in for the rest of your life, control the pension right. yourself because it's private, and own the asset. And by that, what I mean is something happens to you and your wife, the money stays inside your family.
Right.
Versus just disappearing.
And so what numbers are we talking about when we talk about people who are at risk of losing their pension in one way or another?
There's a bunch. And even though there's a bunch, even though you think things look pretty good at your current employer, you don't know what the future has to bring, especially when you think you're going to be retired for 20, 25, 30 years. That's a long time to depend upon your former employer to make good decisions.
We're talking with Bill Geiger of Geiger Wealth Management about what to do when you retire and the fact that more and more of these big pensions are sort of being taken away from you. So some people have a pension, they're going to rely on it, and they're not offered the lump sum. What do those people do?
Well, they got to save as much as they can outside.
Right. I mean, you know, I was telling you off the air.
They have to have a plan B, in other
words. I, from a long time ago, have a pension, and it's not very much, but... or it's not enough to get by on by any means. And I almost think it's not going to be there. I mean, I have that pessimism like a lot of people have for Social Security.
You know, it may not be. And that's why I'm being realistic.
No.
If you have the choice of taking a lump sum instead of that pension, you should really do the math or have somebody help you do the right. math to see if it makes sense
How
for you.
How common is it that people are offered a lump sum?
Pretty common.
Is it?
Pretty common.
Because
it's
good for
the time like that.
Because the business then gets out of it, right?
The business gets out of the long-term liability, and they don't have to worry about it.
Right.
And it's kind of good on both sides to take the lump sum. You know, I know you're going to talk about this in a moment, but Steve, if you're out there listening today and you're coming up on retirement, your late 50s, early 60s, we're going to offer to sit down with the first five callers to do a complimentary full-blown financial plan, and I'll sit down with them personally. And if they have the choice of a lump sum, we'll go into that in depth
right.
with them.
Okay. Thanks very much, Bill. Good to see you again.
You're welcome, sir.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WG on a Thursday afternoon. Elise Klink is on a phone line, of course. We tell you often about bestmoneymoves.com. You should check that out. She's the co-host as well of the Monday Morning Marketing Podcast on WGNplus.com. And she's my personal favorite guest on the Business Lunch. Oh, how are you, Elise?
Oh, so nice to hear that, Steve.
Okay, so are you there? I think I just lost you. Well, that's not good at all. We seem to have just lost Elise. She just dumped out, so we'll try to get her back on. One of the things we're going to talk to Elise about is Steve Mnuchin, who is on Capitol Hill today, a Goldman Sachs guy who has been nominated to be the Secretary of the Treasury for President-elect Trump. And the President-elect, as he arrives in Washington, is Treasury Secretary nominee on Capitol Hill. The New York Times did a story just before the Mnuchin's appearance on the Hill saying that he failed to disclose about $100 million in assets on his Senate financial disclosure forms. Has to do with property. I think it's a Manhattan condo. There's some property in Mexico and all of that. But Mnuchin kind of set aside $100 million. I know where each of my $100 million is, but Steve Mnuchin apparently did not. He said it was a mix-up with lawyers that they didn't think you needed to claim real estate. Elise, are you back?
I am. We just had a crazy power outage. But,
sorry about
that. Landlines, this is how it goes,
I was talking about the Mnuchin $100 million that they didn't report on their ethics committee, or their initial report. But that's not a big deal, I guess, because they've rectified it. I know we're going to talk minutiae, but I got to tell you, you know, Rick Perry is before a Senate committee as well. He's been nominated for energy secretary. And, of course, the energy department is something he campaigned on abolishing. So there's that whole awkward thing. And, you know, he's just a, you know, he's a sort of an upbeat guy, and he says things sometimes that he doesn't quite mean, and that was one. But so I don't know if you saw this, Elise. Al Franken was questioning him. And, you know, before their, before the committee, they have private meetings in their offices, right? So so Rick Perry says to Senator Franken, "I hope you are as much fun on this dais as you were on your couch." And I think that's not what he meant.
Yeah, what does that mean exactly?
He said, "Well, may I rephrase that, please?" And Franken said, "Oh, my Lord, yes, please do."
Steve, I actually have the bite if you want to hear it.
Oh, yeah. Do you have that?
Yeah, I do. Here you go. Okay.
Into my office. Did you enjoy meeting me? I hope you were as much fun on that dais as you were on your couch.
Thank
may,
you, Kim.
May I rephrase that, sir?
Please. Please. Please.
So
there
there's
you go.
That. Yeah, a little levity on Capitol Hill. He's going to win confirmation. I think they're probably
going to laugh a little bit, right?
Yeah, I think they're probably all going to win confirmation in the end. And look, the president gets to pick, or should get to pick. So there's that. How'd Mnuchin, or how's he been doing?
I think he's doing okay. I think he's come back with, you know, the big thing that the Democrats were concerned about, and there were a lot of side hearings from people who had lost their homes, and I received some of those statements today. From some of the organizations supporting that. But the whole thing around IndyMac, I mean, the IndyMac problem was the kind of epicenter of the housing crisis.
Is that what they called the foreclosure machine?
They were the foreclosure machine, correct. And really, IndyMac came out of Countrywide Mortgage. And you may remember Countrywide.
Yeah.
Those were the good guys, and then they became the bad guys, the very bad guys. And IndyMac was this business that sprung up from what Countrywide was doing, which was basically a lot of Alt-A and subprime mortgages. They spun it off. It became hugely profitable. I think it did something like $90 billion worth of loans in the subprime world. And then in 2007, that all blew up. There were a lot of those loans were in California in the Southwest and in Florida. It blew up, and many of those homes went underwater, and then they stopped making their mortgage payments. FDIC took them over, and then just had to basically sell them off, and that became the remains of that became One West, which, you know, was again a problem for foreclosures.
And this was Mnuchin's company.
So Mnuchin came in, and he bought up pieces of IndyMac. That's what he did. That was when it was sold, and he became associated with One West, which was the surviving entity. And then, but IndyMac Bancorp, which was headquartered in Pasadena, ended up buying Financial Freedom, which was a reverse mortgage lender, New York Mortgage Company, which was an East Coast mortgage bank, and Barrington Capital, which was a West Coast bank, and they were trying to basically cover the country.
I think you just read the screenplay for The Big Short.
Well, it's not a surprise that The Big Short really hit home, because it did look a lot at a lot of what IndyMac was doing. And the guy who became famous for The Big Short did a lot of buying against the IndyMac housing tranches, as it were.
Okay, so, but Mnuchin's on Capitol Hill saying, look, I was trying to help people with their mortgages. I wasn't the bad guy here. Does he have a case?
I think that you have to ask yourself, what is it that everybody was trying to do back in 2007? I think that it's fair that Mnuchin was trying to make a lot of money, and he did. Anybody who can afford to forget $100 million has a lot of money. But I don't know that it's fair to hold the lenders beyond the standard that the government itself set, which
right.
was pretty low. I was one of those people who was covering it and wrote a lot of articles about how I thought the government was kind of selling out the foreclosures. Is it fair to say to Mnuchin, you should have done more than the government was asking you to do? I don't know that it is.
Right. So if it's his job, it's his business to make money, and he's following laws, the laws of the land while making that money. What do we accuse him of, not having a big enough heart? I mean, is that it? Is it a moral accusation?
I think it's a moral accusation that doesn't hold water. Where I do have a problem with IndyMac and their surviving One West is that they, like Bank of America and all of the other huge lenders that ran afoul in the housing crisis, they didn't actually, in some cases, live up to the letter of the law. So they put the foreclosure mills into play. People didn't get a fair hearing. People were foreclosed on that didn't even have mortgages. So there was a lot of bad business that went on in 2008, 9, 10, 11, and 12 when the banks and the lenders were trying to catch up. And so that's where I hold him accountable. But that's not the vast majority of what went on. It might be 5 to 10%. And trust me, even one is too many.
Sure.
But I don't think it's really fair to say he either caused the housing crisis, which he didn't do. I do think it's fair to say that he probably could have stayed on top of how the training was going down so that the people who were doing the foreclosure mill work were actually doing it the right way.
Is he qualified and capable of being the Treasury Secretary?
Probably as much so as anyone. Did we rename that as Goldman, you know, Redux? Because isn't this like the fourth person from Goldman who's now going to run Treasury? But anyway, I do think that he probably has enough experience and can learn the rest. I don't know what the perfect Treasury Secretary would be.
Let me ask you this, and I asked this of John Najarian earlier this week, and it's a sincere question. I don't know how to judge yet Donald Trump because I don't know which words matter. You know, I mean, he might say something and then his designees on Capitol Hill say something, you know, completely different. I mean, it certainly was the case with NATO. It's been the case with Russia. And I think with economics and tax cuts for the very wealthy, too. So do you think that Donald Trump has in hand or in his mind a concrete strategy of how he wants to handle the U.S. economy?
I think he does. And I think it remains a complete mystery. There are, like you know, he says one thing. He ran on one thing and now seems to be playing the other side. So it's a little unclear what everybody thought they were voting for, or maybe they were just voting for big change, whatever that means.
Right.
I think we're going to see big change. I do think that even though some people who are getting into these cabinet roles seem a little out of bounds, others seem very conservative and what you might expect. I think Elaine Chao was good to begin with. I think she'll probably be good now, just in a different role. And I hope that somebody like a Rick Perry, now that he actually knows what the Energy Department does and says that, oh, it's probably not a good idea to get rid of it.
Well,
I hope that he's going to rise to the task. And so I don't think anybody really knows what to expect starting on Monday, but I'm sure there'll be lots to talk about.
We're losing Joe Biden, so it's good that we have Rick Perry for a quip once in a while.
And so many others.
Elise Glink, thanks for joining us both times.
Hey, anytime for you, Steve.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, 1251 on 720 WGN. Ian Sefton is a guy who grew up in the L.A. area. He's the man behind Hangar 200, an investment group. But before that, the Marines and college football, and now just successful life in general. And he joins us on the Business Lunch. Ian, welcome. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
So I thought that we might take this time because you certainly are tuned into L.A., and I would like to compare and contrast maybe the startup culture there with here and just talk a little bit about how geography plays with all of that. So we've got a publication here called Chicago Inno, and a couple of the guys are on with me every week. They did a piece a while ago, asked some startup experts in town to describe in a word what the startup community was like here. And some of them are what you would expect, creative, collaborative, happening, special. But the one that strikes me is welcoming, that the idea that the Chicago culture is welcoming. I wonder if any of those five words applies in the same way it would in L.A. or how you think L.A. might be different from Chicago.
Well, I think, you know, words that I would use would be competitive, robust, and dynamic. One of the biggest things that's kind of emerged recently in the last few years has been Silicon Beach, which is kind of the counter to Silicon Valley for Los Angeles. And what we've seen is, you know, with Snapchat, their success, with Google opening offices here, Yahoo early on, but they're obviously less prominent now. But there's been a lot of tech that has been moved down into the Santa Monica kind of South Bay area, and it's really changed just the whole landscape. I mean, real estate prices have gone up in areas that, you know, in LA that normally you wouldn't, you know, aspire to live there, places right. like Westchester and Mar Vista. So, you know, it's an interesting time, I think, for Los Angeles to, in the ecosystem.
I talked to a lot of writers, and I was talking to a novelist from New York. It's been a couple of years ago, and he'd relocated to Chicago. And he said, you know, I always heard people in the Midwest were nice, but it's really kind of odd. They're very nice. And, you know, that fuels things. And I don't think of L.A. as being especially cutthroat or competitive. But do you see Chicago as sort of a laid back, sort of nicer approach, which isn't always together a good thing?
Yeah. You know, I went to business school with a good friend of mine who lives in the Chicago area. We actually talked, knowing that I was going to come on, we talked a little bit about the ecosystem. And he does believe it is more welcoming. And he's, you know, he went to USC with me. We got our MBAs together. So he's seen kind of Silicon Beach and the approach here, and he's seen Chicago and their approach there. Yeah, I would say it is more welcoming. I don't think it's not welcoming in LA. I just think there's right. a lot of competition. Right. I mean, it's just a lot of competition for the right deals in terms of investment. And then also there's a million people trying to start, you know, businesses. The big thing right now for us is mobility. That's the space I play in. And we're seeing a lot of startups tackling mobility, which isn't the sexiest, you know, it's not social media, but it's a real problem. And it's interesting to see people get into that space.
You know, and I wouldn't say that Chicago is not competitive, but I don't think it would be one of the top words, because it just doesn't strike me as that's one of the drivers here. One of my sure. favorite books from last year was this book called Geography of Genius. I don't know if you saw it. It's by a guy named Eric Weiner. And he looked at Silicon Valley, actually, but he looked at Vienna in the 19th century, and he looked at Edinburgh during the Age of Enlightenment, and how what sort of sociological things contributed to this fostering of great creativity through history. He looked at Athens as well. And I've talked a lot on the show about whether or not you can create a zone that fosters creativity in startups like that. And I just wonder what you know, there's all these cities around the country that are trying to create innovation zones and all of that. Do you think that's something that can actually physically be created, or does it have to happen organically?
You know, that's a great question. You know, I've done a little bit of research on Silicon Valley as well. And, you know, a lot of the success and the innovation, especially early on, was funded by the government. And it was funded to kind of combat, you know, the Cold War. And so, you know, you wonder what are these, you know, these events that have to happen and take place to really spur that innovation. You know, I think, you know, L.A. has been known. It's funny. L.A. is known for media and entertainment, and it's always been known for that. And I do see a shift going towards more tech, and I think there's a lot more businesses moving down here. The areas of Silicon Beach are those communities that are popping up. I think the thing that's interesting is that the search for good engineers is really the key. And yeah. That's what I mean by very competitive. To find the best engineers to build these products, especially on the tech side, it creates a very competitive space. You're constantly working with recruiters. You're chasing down. You're offering more and more perks in your business to get them excited to come on. And if you don't have a worthy mission, I don't think you'll find the best engineers, because there's just a lot of really great companies starting right now.
One of the things that Weiner argues that is shared by all of these great moments of creativity is a diversity and a large immigration influx. And in part, that's because there are people seeing things differently, but it's also because then people just aren't settled. They're unsettled. And when they're unsettled, they're more likely to find new alliances and have a creative spark. Does that make sense to you?
It does. It does. And, you know, diversity is something that we have really, you know, in Hangar 202, we have a few investments. One of the big ones that we're really excited about is Synchromatics. You know, we're attacking mobility, and one of the big things that we challenge ourselves is to increase the diversity, not just for the sake of diversity, but right. for the sake of perspective, because everyone has a unique perspective based on how they were brought up and where they're from. And, you know, we've made a lot of outreach to, and especially on the female engineering side, because that is actually one of the hardest things to find is female engineers. And we've had some success.
You talked about Synchromatics a couple of times, and I know that's a big one for you, but I want to know about Otto's Tacos.
Yeah, Otto's Tacos is an interesting opportunity. We collaborated. One of my partners was the founder of Houston Tillstone, so one of the most successful restaurant brands in the U.S. There's actually some in Chicago as well, Bandera and Houston's and Tillstone.
So, Ian, there's a Bandera about 100 yards from me.
Yeah. So that was his creation. And, you know, he sold out to one of his partners, and we got together in 2010, and we've been doing deals ever since. We looked at Otto's Tacos after going to New York a couple times and not seeing LA style street tacos, which is a unique taco compared to some of the Tex-Mex and things that people had seen. And so we've got three open, one Yelp's best taco in New York and a few other things. And it's a really fun, kind of cool brand and a very interesting founder who's more passionate about tech than tacos initially, but grew up in Southern California and could not find great Mexican food while he was at NYU. So saw a problem and figured out a solution.
That's
really fun one.
That's Ian Sefton with The View from LA. Ian, great to talk to you. Hope we can do it again.
All right. Sounds good. Take care.